In the desert basins and mountain ranges of the Southwest, you will discover on the surfaces of boulders and rock exposures galaxies of enigmatic figures chiseled or scribed or painted by human hands hundreds of thousands of years ago. On stony surfaces across the arid land, you may find, for instance, strangely abstracted and haunting graphic expressions of a human mind, perhaps the work of a shaman reaching for the spirit world. You may find figures awash in symbolism of prehistoric deities, rituals, masks, dance, ceremonies, and pilgrimages. You can see portrayals of warriors with shields, each covered with the symbols of the owner's magic. You may find representational, stylized, or even whimsical depictions of men, women, and children, mammals, birds, fish, reptiles, and insects, and agricultural plants, especially corn. You will often see images of human faces, eyes, handprints, footprints, and animal and bird tracks. Always you will find geometric designs, for instance, spirals, concentric circles, zigzags, parallel lines, and step fret shapes. Should you explore the rock art of our deserts, you may become ensnared in one of the great mysteries of Southwestern archaeology. What do the images signify? What do they mean? Anthropologist and investigator Kay Sutherland has suggested that prehistoric shamans may have produced rock art for use as portals through which they could enter the spirit world. These images on stone, says preeminent authority Polly Schaafsma, are probably humankind's most enduring art form. They also rank high among humankind's most beguiling and mysterious expressions of worldviews and belief systems. Words of Jay Sharp in his essay, Petroglyphs, Pictographs, Rock Art, published in connection with the Three Rivers site in New Mexico. As it happens, artist Karen Aqua asks, as she creates her work, how can I express this or that in images? How can I figure out symbols that represent emotional states or approaches to life without words? She wants to take us on a journey into a rich, imaginative space. And she, too, works with her hands. Since 1976, Karen Aqua has created animated films exploring the themes of ritual, journeys, transformation, and the human spirit. Much of her work reflects an interest in symbols, mythology, and prehistoric and tribal cultures, and includes elements of rhythm, dance, and music. Her award-winning films have been screened nationally and internationally at film festivals, museums, and universities. And as Barbara Ensor writes in New York Magazine, children across the country get up and dance next to their cereal bowls when Sesame Street airs Karen Aqua's animated segments. It would be hard to stay still as bejeweled Mardi Gras figures jive across the small screen, flashing numbers at the audience, accompanied by the Revolutionary Snake Ensemble, a band that's led off-screen by her saxophone-tooting husband, Ken Field. Karen Aqua is a native of the Wyoming Valley here in northeastern Pennsylvania. She has been making animated films since her graduation from the Rhode Island School of Design in 1976. She has received film production grants from the American Film Institute, the Massachusetts Council on the Arts and Humanities, the New England Film Video Fellowship Program, the New Forms Regional Initiative, the Massachusetts Cultural Council, and the Puffin Foundation. She has been artist-in-residence at the McDowell Colony, Jurassic Foundation, Millay Colony, Roswell Artist-in-Residence Program, Atlantic Center for the Arts, and the Fundación Valparaíso in Spain. Karen Aqua was a lecturer in animation at Boston College from 1984 through 1991 and animation instructor at Emerson College in 1987. She has served as a juror for major animation and film festivals in the United States and Canada and has presented one-person screenings of her work at the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, the Institute of Contemporary Art in Boston, the California Institute of the Arts at Dartmouth College, and the University of Oregon. Since 1990, she has produced, directed, and animated 22 segments for the acclaimed PBS television program Sesame Street. Karen Aqua and musician and composer Ken Field paid a visit to the WVIA studios while she was back in the region recently to talk with us about her films and Ken and Karen's collaboration. First, though, we talked about this place, home.
I was born and raised in this area, and my brother and I love to draw since as long as I can remember. So definitely before I was in kindergarten, he would give me what we would call little informal drawing lessons just around the house, and we would just pick something from some either a subject, let's draw a zoo, or something in front of us, and just draw together. And one that I remember was, let's draw a zoo, and at some point halfway through drawing it, I turned my paper upside down, so half the cages were right side up and half were upside down. So that's one of my early 40 fort memories of drawing. And yes, so I always drew. I always knew that I wanted to do something with visual arts. I wasn't sure exactly what. In junior high, I was really interested in fashion design, and that led me to discover this school, Rhode Island School of Design. Over the next few years in high school, I got less interested in fashion and more in something else in fine arts, but wasn't sure. And by then, I was for sure going to art school. Actually, in seventh grade is when Valley West was formed, the merging. And so by the time I got to high school, there was a great art program and very varied. And so by my senior year, all I was doing was taking art classes. I'd fulfill all my requirements. So I took painting and ceramics and art 1, 2, 3, 4 and everything I could get my hands on with art. So some of the stuff I really haven't continued with, like painting, but I was really kind of going for art all the way from a very young age. So Rhode Island School of Design was just like sort of moving towards that.
As far as the history of this area, I was reading about your interest in tribal things and ritual. Did the fact that Francis Slocum and those Native American stories here have any formative influence?
You know, maybe on some subconscious level, I know my brother was really interested in history. And I think I didn't realize, sometimes you don't see stuff in your backyard. And I didn't start to really pay attention more to Native American culture until I traveled out west. And actually, that's when I noticed it. And then I realized, you know, there's so much history in the East, too. And the Historical Society, I could have been kind of learning about that stuff and looking at probably some ancient sites here. But it really was kind of not on my radar back in those days.
So you went then to art school. Then how did you begin to get into animation?
Animation. Well, I was actually an illustration major. And at that time, the school had some majors that were more loosely structured. And illustration was one of them. So it gave me a lot of room for electives. And I wasn't convinced I wanted to be an illustrator. But it gave me a very good drawing and design background. So that was to my advantage. And rather than be a film major, which would have been more technical, I felt. So in my junior year, I took a couple of film electives, a live action film class and an animation class. And the live action class was fun, but my personality is much more to do something alone with complete control and not to have to work with other people, depend on other people. And I realized live action film is more about a group kind of experience. And so animation, it took about a semester for it to click, but once it clicked, it was a kind of obsessive relationship. That was junior year in college. And then senior year, I just did animation, pretty much concentrated on that for my senior thesis project. And there's been no turning back.
And what had you been exposed to in terms of animation up to your junior year? What kinds of things had you gone to see? Some of these wonderful animation festivals in Canada?
Actually, we saw some films in college, but not as many as I've seen over the years since. And I do remember a show when I was probably in high school that was on public TV called, I think, International Animation Festival or something like that. And I do remember thinking, this stuff's pretty cool. And I wasn't thinking, oh, this is what I want to do, but it definitely sparked something at the time. And the couple months after I graduated from Rhode Island School of Design, the first animation festival in Ottawa, Canada was taking place. And so it's funny that you mentioned that, because that was really an education. I saw hundreds of films in about 5 days and saw all the important animators from actually around the world in front of me, and I said, oh, this is the world I want to be in. So that was a really well-timed event for me to say, I'm about to enter the real world, whatever the real world means in 1976 is really different than now. But it was a very glorious time for independent animation. People were getting grants. People were making their own films. And it seemed, oh, this is a world I want to be in for sure. And it kind of like almost saw these golden gates open up and say, come on. And so at that point, I had a 4-minute film under my belt, and that was it. And I said, okay, I want to make a body of work. And so that was about 76. I finally have over an hour of films. How many years later? 35. I figured out in 35 years, I've done about 70 minutes of film, about 2 minutes a year. But not every year. That's a good year.
And people can't, I'm sure, conceive, even if they've seen those behind the scenes with Disney, how labor intense.
The word is insanity, really. Well, another thing is, what people sometimes see is a group studio project. And when you have even 2 people or 5 people or 100 people or 20 working on a film, maybe they're going to spend 3 years. Maybe it's a feature, though. I, as one person working by myself, sometimes spend 3 years on a 5-minute film. Yeah, it's crazy. It gives you a very different relationship with time and with making projects. One analogy I have is a friend of ours built a barn at his farm in Maine in the amount of time that it took me to make a film. You know, you walk into this amazing building that didn't exist before, and for me, I have like a reel of film. I mean, it's ridiculous, but everybody has their thing that they're obsessed about, and that is what they do, and some people just don't get what each other does, you know.
He created space in a certain way, but you... Mm-hmm. In your way, can create a space for our imagination. Frankly.
Well, that's how I feel about animation too, but it is sometimes hard to explain, you know, why spend that long on something that short. And when you're first starting out, it seems like you're never going to get to a half an hour. You know, it seems like it takes forever. It really does take forever. You have to love it.
In the time from 1976 to now, the technology must have developed in a way that
right.
You have a choice now.
Well, I'll say the technology has changed a heck of a lot more than I have changed. And I still really like working with real materials and getting my hands dirty. And I'm not enamored of the computer. So I use it just as a tool to help me see my work in a more immediate way than I used to do on my tests and had to send them to a film lab. So that's the part of the process that's changed the most for me. But there's things about it that are negative. Because I can see instantly, almost, my drawings move, I can also tweak them to such an obsessive degree that you couldn't make as many changes before. And so I can really drive myself nuts with that. So some of the tools I now use, but I work a little more digitally when I work with teaching than for my own work. But I know it's there if I need it, and I know I'm never going to completely be interested in making a film that just exists not on paper. It's not as much of what I do. I love to draw, basically.
There is something about that ability to judge by eye.
I think there is. I think there's some processes that are different. And one thing I think about is, if you're designing something, a graphic piece, and you have to figure out where the center is, you have to center something. There is a skill. There's something about your eye knowing when something's centered. Then the computer say, this is centered. And I just think these are some really important visual, I don't know if the word is skill or just a sense of things, that I think you really should have that stuff too. And so I think relying on a machine to do all that thinking for you, I don't think is a great idea. So I think people, if they choose to do all the work later in computer, I think people who work visually, I think should still kind of have that in their background. I hope, in a perfect world.
And sense of color. You have an extraordinary sense of color.
Oh, thank you.
Was that always part when you were doing the zoos and so forth? Did you always love to lavish on work?
Funny, the zoo was black and was just pencil on, remember the yellow paper with the blue lines? Yeah, well, we drew a lot on that paper. My oldest, earliest drawings are the little just pencil drawings. But I did do a series, the fashion design sketches in seventh grade or so, definitely getting into color. And it was the era of mod and op and all that kind of stuff. So there were a few colorful things. But definitely in high school, I was getting into painting, and I think the colors were getting more vivid. And over the years of doing animation, well, one thing is film. I just was really drawn to really saturated color. In film, it looks really good projected, you know. So I realized a lot of my films don't have very much white in them, like no white backgrounds. Some of my very early film has a little white in some of the backgrounds. My most recent film does too. But a lot of the stuff in between, very saturated colors. And another thing is sort of what materials are available did influence that a little. I use paper often that's just like Xerox copy paper. And in my early films, my backgrounds were the colors of those papers. So they might be light blue or yellow. And then over the years, they got fluorescent colors and really saturated blues and everything. And so my palette changed a little as the materials offered me more. Yeah.
What about thematic explorations then? You could be interested in anything, but you found a way and a sensibility that was a good match for you.
Yeah. Well, it must have been something that clicked for me in the early days of watching animation. The ones that really resonated were not so much the funny, jokey films and not necessarily the real narrative films, although there are some narrative animations that I love and admire. But the stuff that was more interesting to me was somehow in a graphic way moving somebody through some sort of journey, some sort of experience. So that's a pretty broad kind of approach, but basically a non-narrative approach, but using recognizable things. But then over the years, I've moved into more abstraction. I like for people to have to meet me halfway, and I don't like spelling it out for them. And my films are nonverbal. And that could be a partly subconscious choice of going to animation festivals that are international, and how great that you don't have to send a script and you don't have to worry about people understanding language to hopefully get what you're trying to say. But also, I'm a visual person, and I used to write in a journal. I used to love creative writing in high school too. But it's more about the images than the words. And what was always a really interesting thing to me is, how can I express this, something or other, in images? How can I figure out symbols that represent emotional states or approaches to life or whatever? And so I always thought that was a really cool challenge. I love that interplay, and it's different for everybody. And what I also love is when somebody comes up to me and says, oh, I think this was about this for me. And sometimes it's a little different than what I had thought about, and that's always great. So as far as what my films are about, that has changed a lot over the years. A lot of it comes from things that I see in the world, sometimes travel, sometimes other cultures. You had mentioned tribal cultures that really became a huge interest for me with trips out west. And then my most recent film, the motivation came from a more, I guess, personal and, I guess we'll call it internally driven, of a kind of personal crisis I was going through and dealing with it. So the motivation for each film is different, but there is sort of some kind of relationship or continuum. And definitely what ties them all together is a way of expressing things that not necessarily are verbal through images.
And then, of course, music is its own language.
Oh, yeah.
Without words,
right,
necessarily.
Right.
And we're sitting here with a collaborator of yours who is a musician and a composer. Hi, Ken.
Hello.
As you hear Karen talking about her work, was it her work that you first noticed? Did you know her work before you knew her?
No, I knew her before I knew her work. In fact, I knew her before there was work.
Sure.
We've known each other for quite a long time. since 1975. And
the
maybe
year
a little
I
before.
Started to do animation.
And I'm really proud that I was involved in helping Karen put together her very first soundtrack. In fact, that was a class project that she hasn't released publicly particularly. And part of the reason is that it includes some music by Eric Dolphy that I suggested that she use for this piece. And of course, we don't have the rights to that, so that stays a class project. But then her senior project was a film, what was that called, Penetralia?
Yes.
And Karen asked me to play flute, and a friend of mine played vibraphone, and we improvised to the animation. It's something that is exceedingly embarrassing to me to watch at this point, but I think the vibes player did great, you know, and I did my best. And then through the years, I've been, you know, just thrilled to be able to collaborate with Karen on many of her films, not all of them, but many of them, up through the most recent one.
And we couldn't be in a building that houses a public television station without talking about your work for Sesame Street.
Oh, yes, of course.
How did that come about, and do you work the same way when you're thinking about the little ones?
Well, that was my luckiest break, I would say. It came about that I had a film that was in a touring show, and somebody from Sesame Street saw the publicity materials from it and liked the image. And so the person who was distributing the show said, call Sesame Street, they want to talk to you. Now, interestingly enough, a couple years before that, I did approach Sesame Street with my reel, and it didn't yet have that film on it, so it was a little earlier. But there was a different person in charge at that point of those acquisitions, and she had a different sensibility, and she thought my work was too sophisticated for that age range. Now, the new person who came in, the most wonderful producer, Arlene Sherman, the late Arlene Sherman, she had an amazing approach of not talking down at all to kids, and so they can take anything. And she was just the greatest person to work for. So that's how my foot got in the door, was just them seeing an image from one of my films and liking it. It might have been a case of mistaken identity, but that's okay. And then working for them, well, a big difference is that when I set out to teach counting or an alphabet or a concept like backwards and forwards, it's pretty easy to know when the concept clicks, you know, when you know I've done it. Whereas when I'm making a film about a kind of complicated subject, it's hard to know if I've done it. So it's a little easier to get satisfaction of knowing that I got it to work. And then from the very beginning of working for Sesame Street, which was 13 years working freelance, I always worked with my own music people, mostly Ken, and Sesame Street really liked the music he did too. So over the years, they always liked me to do it as a package with the music. And then over the years, we also started to add lyrics and had little songs and things. And the reason for that is I kind of got hip to this thing that's called royalties. The animators don't get royalties, the composers do, the lyricists also do. So I figured I can probably handle writing some kids' lyrics, and so I did have that ulterior motive when I started to do it.
Karen's pretty sharp.
And was it fun for you to do the Sesame Street?
It was way fun, yeah. For the same reason that Karen mentioned, that Arlene Sherman voiced very clearly her perspective that this should not be, quote-unquote, kids' music or animation, that this should be music that that kids can listen to, I mean, but that adults would appreciate as well. And what I was able to do for the music in general was my own music, you know? And it's music that has then taken a life of its own in some cases, where I record and perform some of these pieces as expanded pieces with my own ensembles. And you know, people get a kick out of it when they learn that it was written for Sesame Street, but it's still good music. And I think it's the same for Karen's animation. Also, it's great to do a little one-minute thing. You know, you get to get your concept in there, and you do it, and you get out. And, you know, I personally am a short-form kind of guy. And so expanding something to, you know, a 20-minute symphony is a very big challenge to me. But I'm writing a one-minute piece of music. You know, you get your idea in there and you do it. And the other thing is that the topic, and a lot of times Karen's animation, the tempo when you have those kinds of constraints imposed on you from the outset of a project, it makes life a lot easier. You know, you're not working from a total tabula rasa and saying, well, gee, what do I do now? You have something set in front of you as an assignment, kind of, and that makes it easier and fun as well.
Today on Art Scene, Karen Aqua, award-winning artist and animator, and her husband, musician and composer Ken Field, talking with us about Karen's films and their collaborations on a recent return to northeastern Pennsylvania. For more information, on the web at karenaqua.com, and that's A-Q-U-A, karenaqua.com.